Bevan Laurie, Reel 8.
So, following Arno Ride's broadcast on the Saturday lunchtime, the government seized the opportunity finally to wipe the British Council off the face of its country. And in the following week, on the radio and through all the media, there came out the word that British Council staffed with the dregs of humanity, who failed in every other career, and had landed up in the council. And then the following day, we were running escape routes out of Czechoslovakia, and then we were spies, and then the next day again we were assassins, and the final thing was that we had cannibalistic tendencies, and of course there was nothing to gainsay them. They had total control of all the media, and so we were given a week to leave. And we had a huge library there, and we all had all our personal effects. And it was quite a job. Not only that, but before they would allow us out, they insisted that we list in minute detail every dress, every pair of stockings, every shoe, every everything, and where we bought it and how much we paid for it. Purely uncertain as an annoyance tactic. And even when, on the way out, Leonard Tibbett, the English language expert, had an artificial leg. He had been involved in a streetcar accident in Cairo, and because the beastly thing was horribly uncomfortable, he always carried a spare. And there was a great altercation between the customs officers about insisting on opening the spare artificial leg, and not realizing that Leonard was fluent in Czech. They were discussing how they were going to burst it open, and the senior man was saying, "Don't be a fool, there'll be an international incident," and so on. And it was all made pettily and pathetically difficult. And the send-off that we were given was heartbreaking for so many of all age groups who had looked to the British Council as the one speck of light on their horizon, really, in those circumstances. This was, you know, the end of all hope. And we were seen off at both railway stations that served Prague with bouquets of flowers and so on and so forth. But the really amusing thing was, in those days, the role of women in Czechoslovakia was somewhat behind what had developed in this country. Czech girls tended to be cherub-faced, you know, round and beautiful, and very young looking and entirely adorable. But because there really was not a great deal of option for them in terms of career and study and so on and so forth, if they hadn't got married by the age of about 23, 24, they were wont to go into a decline and have a nervous breakdown. And some kind of reflection of this, the young men of Prague thought English girls were fine because not one of us had any intention of marrying any of them. And so we were taken skating on the frozen river Vltava, and we were taken out to the opera, which was beginning to renew itself in those days, at the Prague Opera House, and entertained incredibly generously in people's homes and so on, to their own marked danger. And so when finally we came to leave, many of the people who had been a great part of boosting the British Council's effort in Prague, and in the whole of Czechoslovakia, we had offices in Brno and also in Bratislava, and you know, people like Professor Vocadlo, V-O-C-A-D-L-O, with a heartache over the sea.
Could you say that again, please?
Professor Vocadlo, V-O-C-A-D-L-O, who was a very able and very senior professor of English. And there were numbers of the professors in the Charles University who had been immensely supportive of the British Council coming in the first place and working there. They'd put their backs behind us again at considerable risk to themselves, and they were all at one station or the other to see us off. And I think we all felt it was just immensely sad. The Czechs had gone through so much during the war and had come through with such hopes, and then lo and behold, the darkness of absolutely blanketing communism had seized a hold of them. It was really very sad.
Would you have been there at the time when Masaryk, was it Jan Masaryk, committed, well, it was said that he committed suicide. Were you there at the time?
I think I was. You know, the silly thing is that one's recollections, the names are so familiar and the events are so familiar, but I think it may have been while I was there. And all those people, Baelish, Masaryk, the university and so on, were all in very close contact with Reg Kos, who actually, there came a certain point when he had to be pulled out. I didn't realise this at the time, but I've since read an incomplete autobiography that he's written for his friends and family. And there came a point after On the Wilds broadcast when he was strongly advised to get out and to get out quickly. He had young children, and he was replaced by the next rep, who was Dick Hollier, H-O-L-L-Y-E-R. He was a New Zealander. But in spite of the darkness of that period and one's intense sympathy and concern for the people of Czechoslovakia, it was a wonderful episode in my life, and Prague is a beautiful, beautiful city with an absolute plethora of most gorgeous Baroque churches and the old historic castle and the cathedral up on the hill and so on. It's a lovely, lovely city. And there were lighter, amusing incidents with Marjorie Whittaker on one occasion. We went off for a weekend out a little way outside Prague, and we found ourselves staying in an hotel which obviously had become the domain of the fat cats of the communist regime. And fat applied in both meanings, and there would be these round and barrel-like little Czech wives with incredibly short skirts, which were not in fashion at that time, and their overfed husbands. But actually, the trip out was the thing that was amusing. We went to the bus station, and at that time, you didn't queue. You stood and you waited. And when the bus came along, there was a mad scrum to sit on the roof, to cling onto the back, to get inside. And every second person had a live beastie of some kind. They were either carrying a squawking goose, or hens, or chickens, or shoulders of meat of this kind, this, that, and the next kind. Clearly, the country was in a better economic state, as I think very often happens, than the town. And it reached the point where Marjorie and I had managed to get into the bus, but we very quickly found that if you were stupid enough to pick up one foot in order to scratch your ankle, there was no space to put it down again, you know. And the countryside was lovely. On one occasion, I did what was known as the ration run down to Bratislava. Certain provisions we got through the embassy commissariat, and once a month we took rations down to our two more easterly stations, and somebody was always sent down to combine the run with a lecture, and it was my turn to do the ration run. And it was in the spring of 1950, and a whole long stretch of the road down on the way towards Bratislava was fruit-growing area, and the blossom was out of this world. It was just, you know, a delicate kind of fairyland scene. And wherever we went, people were just quite enormously kind to us. In a certain way, it made the more sinister side, in as much as it affected us, you know, the sleuths who followed us and the scares that were set up for us, It made them unreal. Partly, of course, because we knew very well that we could get out. You know, if anything went seriously astray, we would be picked up and out.
And you left in 1950, was it?
In the summer of 1950.
Yes, yes. What date did you get married?
1952, the 8th of March.
And, of course, you married a conscientious objector, didn't you?
I married a conscientious objector. Todd came out of China shortly before I came out of Czechoslovakia. And something that was quite fascinating about that was the close parallels between communist methods in two such entirely different countries.
What was Todd doing in China?
Well, Todd was returning in 1950 from his second stint in China. During the war, he went out to serve with the Fens Ambulance Unit, China Convoy, and came back home in 1945 with such a deep love of China and its language and its history and its culture and its people that he deliberately sought a job that would take him back. And it happened that at that time the British Council was recruiting for China. And Todd went out. And at that time, in his own mind, he would happily have spent the rest of his professional career in China.
So he would have been with the Friends Ambulance Unit, who were a group of conscientious objectors.
That's correct.
Yes. Mm. How did you relate to that concept? Because obviously you have explained how you had rather ambivalent feelings about the war, but how eventually you came round to thinking it had to be fought because you knew the evil of Hitler. Am I right in that's what you're...
Yes, in a way, although at the back of my mind, after that statement, I still felt in my own right that war had not solved. The war had created problems rather than solved them all. When I met Todd, Todd and I were posted back into the same department of the British Council in London. And at the time I was becoming bored stiff with living in bedsitters. And so I set out to find somewhere that I could rent. And technically, Todd married his landlady. I rented three floors of a house on the north side of Regent's Park, which belonged at the time to the immediately retired commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Hugh Turnbull. And he would not rent the flats separately. And so I drew my secretary in. She took the basement flat. I took the second floor flat. There were two others which were already bespoke. And so there was the ground floor flat. And Todd was in the same department, and I heard that he was looking for accommodation, so I broached the idea to him, and he moved in, and the three of us occupied the three flats at the same time. I suppose one of the strongest influences in my thinking and rethinking was the fact that I fell in love with Todd. We simply hit it off together. We found that although we had come from, in many ways, quite markedly different, certainly areas of Britain, and therefore backgrounds, Todd's father was a highly successful businessman, that we had a great deal in common. We could sit and natter to each other. We enjoyed the same things. We laughed at many of the same things. We went to the theatre together. We just enjoyed each other's company. And I have never before been exposed, as I said earlier, to an alternative to waging war when war hit your country. Todd was the channel through which I was exposed. He had clearly done a tremendous amount of deep thinking about this, and the more I listened to him, his thinking seemed to complement the stage that I had reached. I had, through my own experience, learnt so much about the absolute appalling horrors of war. In a curious kind of way, as Todd illuminated me on his side of the picture, I illuminated Todd through what had happened to me. And I remember very clearly, shortly after we were married, in the course of a discussion, with the utmost seriousness, he spoke about the steady climb of humanity towards civilization and understanding and love. And my mouth dropped open and I said, what price the concentration camps, you know? So we had a tremendous lot to exchange. Moreover, we were neither of us babes. When I met Todd, he was 33, I was 26. And as it happened, both of us had had a fairly action-packed experience up to that time. And so we were endlessly prepared to listen to each other and to be open to the other's point of view. And so at no point was it even remotely battle stations on that front. And the longer we spent time together and the older we have grown, despite the fact that I know that Todd sometimes feels that had he known what was happening in Europe, he doesn't know how he would have managed not to enlist. But deep in our inmost beings, and basically on the result of deep Christian conviction, we do not think that war is the way. One of the tremendous richnesses of my life since I met Todd has been coming into contact with the FAU, not only the China convoy, initially the China convoy, and the thing that was so striking about that at the various reunions that I attended was the way in which one was warmly welcomed into the companionship of the unit. Not only that, but the fact that every single one of the FAU members whom I had the privilege of meeting had gone on in the course of their lives to choose a pattern of living and a pattern of work which was actively constructive. You know, they worked in relief organizations, they worked in connection with the abolition of the slave trade, they were deeply involved in Oxfam, or in one way or another, they had found themselves, and I think probably by this stage it was deeply inbred in them, that life was to be used with a sense of purpose and a sense of commitment. And I find that tremendously impressive. I came to love many of them. I certainly had the deepest respect for them all. And wherever we have been, actually the reason why we were not married in a Quaker service, having attended the Quaker meeting for the month since we became engaged by common consent, was that Todd comes from generations of Methodism, and he feels that he owes a tremendous debt to his Methodist background, his Methodist home, and all that it has meant to him. And my feeling is that that will be with him as long as he lives. Interestingly, I moved to a different church about 18 years ago, which has been in many ways extremely hard, in many ways of great value to both of us. I, through a series of experiences, I came to believe that what I needed at that time was real, serious Bible study. And in Cambridge, there was, at that time, a young man by the name of Roy Clements, who had started life as a very able student of chemistry and a very happy atheist. And in his student days, when he was planning to go on and do a PhD in chemistry, which he did, he came into contact with Christianity and took the greatest delight in arguing the toss, until somebody said to him, Roy, have you ever read the textbook? And he stopped in his tracks and said, what do you mean? And the person to whom he was talking said, well, I would have thought that a scientist like you would go back to sources. And he put a Bible in Roy's hands. who Roy, with a certain sense of rebellion and perversity, said, right, I'll read this book. And that was the beginning of his conversion. And he is, without exception, the most gifted and galvanizing Bible teacher that I have ever encountered.
And what is the name of your church?
Eden Baptist.
Eden?
Eden Baptist. And so with tremendous heart searching, I stopped going with Todd to the Wesley Church and started attending Eden. It happened because one of our daughters and her husband, having been out in Kenya at the time when Roy was there, Janie had attended Roy's church, came back and went to Eden, and came to us one day and said, would you mind if we were baptized? And we said, no, but we'd like to know why. So together, we started going, and I stayed on. And in a way, it's been enormously hard, because one of the strengths of our marriage was the total sadness of our Christianity. In another way, it's been exceedingly good for us, because it's provoked us to discuss and talk in a way that hadn't happened up to that time. So, there we are.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Beryl, for telling me so much, you know, about your war and your post-war experiences. It has been very interesting.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.